The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I am the conscience of psychiatry. If you have any doubt, take a look at my latest blog on Huffington Post. You can just go right to huffingtonpost.com and then plug in Bragan. It's about Xanax. You know, Whitney Houston meant a lot to a lot of us. And really, as I write in the blog, she meant a great deal to me. She became like the voice of love for me. And on the possibility that she was taking Xanax at the time of her death, there's reports of Xanax in her room, I wrote a blog on the real dangers of Xanax, because all the other stuff being written doesn't really come near to pointing out just how potentially deadly this drug is, how it spellbinds, how it ruins judgment, how it allows people to make terrible mistakes like drinking again or drinking too much or taking other drugs along with it, and how, even though it may not be the agent that actually kills the individual, it's the facilitator, the enabler, the drug that, in my terms of my concept of medication spellbinding, leads the person down a dangerous path. Now, it's just a 6 weeks until our April 13th to 15th, 2012 conference in Syracuse, New York. The Empathic Therapy Conference starts on Thursday the 13th and goes through the Sunday afternoon. We're going to have 30 marvelous speakers and breakout sessions on every conceivable topic. We're going to have some really amazing panels, one on the disorder tardive dyskinesia caused by the antipsychotic drugs that is literally ruining the nervous systems of millions of people. We're going to have another panel on SSRIs, people who have lost loved ones. One of my legal clients is going to come, a young man who ended up spending time in jail, but not as much as he would have without my intervention, who went ahead and just robbed banks in a bizarre, not banks, but gasoline stations in his own neighborhood, where he and his family patronized without wearing any disguise in front of cameras, whacked out on an SSRI antidepressant. We're going to have presentations on how to help elderly, demented people without psychiatric drugs, how to help children without psychiatric drugs. It's just going to be inspiring on both the ends of being the critique of psychiatry, conventional psychiatry, and offering all kinds of other alternatives. Bert Caron, the great grandfather now of clinical psychology, awards like Psychologist of the Year, a really incredible man. He and I are going to have a conversation Saturday night. We're just going to sit with everybody and have some donuts and coffee or whatever else my wife arranges for dessert. And we're going to talk and let you talk with us about everything in psychology and psychiatry and counseling. Now, the big news is that Ginger is my wife, who runs the conference, has decided she's not going to run one, most probably pretty much made up her mind not to run one in 2013. So this will be the last time for 2 years that we'll be having a conference. We'll probably hold one in 2014. But we're going to skip a year. So this is the one to come to. And we still have spots open, although things are pouring in. So go online to empathictherapy.org, empathictherapy.org. You can also get there from my website, bregan.org. And come see us. Come see us. Come see yourself in a whole new light when you're surrounded by like minds. It's an incredible experience. You actually see yourself in a whole new way when you're with people who are with you, really with you. My guest today is wow. I think he's wow. His name is Derek W. Clark. He's written a book, I Will Never Give Up. I Will Never Give Up. That's his website as well. I think it's iwillnevergiveup.com, but he can confirm or deny that. I've seen him on the internet. He's incredible. I don't know what he's going to be like on the radio. I've seen him rap on the internet. Amazing. Now, and I mean amazing. Derek had an incredibly abusive childhood. And he's not only written a book, but he has become an advocate for triumph over abuse. He's become an advocate for turning around the doctor's diagnoses and the grim reaper of psychiatry descending upon the child and for triumphing over it. One of the things I found most interesting is that he had to have a speech therapist. Now, God knows what the speech therapist did, so we'll find out about that. But if you find him on the web, and I'm going to ask him to tell you how to find him rapping, you'll wonder, speech therapist, he's super speech man. I want to welcome Derek Clark to the show. Are you there, Derek?
Hey, Peter, how are you?
It's great to be good. Here. I'm all jazzed up just about having you on the show.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a great honor to be here and have you ask me questions and determine how I became sane.
Well, that's it. Let's see if we can figure out, and in the last 5 minutes, announce how Derek W. Clark, who never should have become sane, became super.
Yeah, thank you.
Start wherever you want.
Yeah, my website that you can find out a lot of information about me is iwillnevergiveup.com. iwillnevergiveup.com. There's a actual button on there called Motivational Videos, and you'll be able to see some of my rap in there. You know, I grew up in Alameda County, San Francisco Bay Area, as a foster youth, and that was a way for me to get, you know, a lot of my anger and resentment and bitterness and rage out was through rap. So, you know, when I speak to thousands upon thousands of people from Canada to Australia, and this is my job, I'm a speaker and author, and I go out there and I always share my music in my presentation. So I might go, well, I'd be the ripping and thinking, I'm making the sucking, I'm making the kicking his own. What's this white boy doing on the microphone? And so, you know,
I love it. You can just break out into rap anytime you want. In fact,
yeah,
let's start the second half hour specifically with you doing a little bit. Anytime, just break right out.
Yeah, there you go. I'm breaking stereotypes, right? But this is how I'm going to share with you how I came into this world here. My mother had a child from a previous marriage, my older sister, who's 10 years older than I. And so my mom hooks up with my dad, who repeatedly raped her and beat her, but for some reason she liked him. And my mom came from an abusive household as well. So obviously the cycle continues. But my dad was so angry that she was going to have me. He wanted her to have an abortion. See, he already had his own family, his own kids, his own wife, and this was something that I guess that happened on the side. She got pregnant, and she would not have the abortion. And when she was 7 months pregnant, waitressing at a diner in San Diego, my dad comes in there, takes her to the back in the kitchen area, throws her on the ground, and proceeds to stomp and kick her stomach over and over again, and throwing her and pushing her in an effort to kill me, because he said to my mom, I'm going to kill that child. He didn't know who I was at that point. I'm going to kill that child. I don't want that kid. I'm not paying child support. Well, I lived. And you cannot tell me there is not a purpose for every one of us out there. I have a purpose in this life, a calling in this life like everybody, and we have to overcome adversity and find our greatness. And so my mom, the records state that my dad brutally abused me for the first year. And I'm like, what do you mean brutally abused? It's unbelievable. You know, I have four kids myself, and I would never, ever think that somebody would do that to such a precious little child. And so my mom got back with this guy and then eventually had the courage after a year to run away from him with me and my sister, and we lived in my aunt's garage. And my dad eventually found us. He was an alcoholic. He came into the garage drunk, threw down a beer bottle, picked up the neck of the broken beer bottle there, and stuck it to my mom's neck and says, I'm going to kill you and Derek. I never wanted that kid. And so she's screaming, my sister's screaming, my aunt calls the cops, and that is the last time I ever saw my dad, ever. And that was it, at 1 year old. The last time I've ever laid my eyes on him. And my mom...
Derek, do you have any... The odds are small. Do you have any memory of that?
No, not at all.
I wouldn't think so. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, this is just a story that my mom told me.
Right.
I met 25 years later.
Okay,
so my mom hooks up. Yeah, my mom hooks up with another guy, gets pregnant, three kids, three different men, and this guy pretends like he likes me, my stepdad. And, you know, he doesn't like me, realistically. I mean, how would you like some? How can you like somebody when you beat them and drown them and hold them and continually almost drown them in the toilets? And that's what he would do with me. Is every time I wet my bed or did something wrong, he would take me to the toilet and hold my head down. And I remember this one time he was holding me down too long, and I could hear my mom saying, I was like 4 or 5 years old, I could hear my mom saying, you're holding them down too long. You're holding them down too long. And as I'm bent over on the toilet with my hands on the toilet bowl to keep my head up from drowning, she pulls my left hand back so hard, my arm so back, that she rips my arm from my socket, and it never gets fixed, and she puts me in a sling, and I've always had trouble with my left shoulder. In fact, when you look at pictures of me, you always see my left shoulder higher than my right shoulder. There's a lot of built-up scar tissue in there. So I was amazed that my mom would even allow this to happen, but my mom is no angel. My mom, my favorite word at 5 years old was the F word. The really bad word rhymes with luck. And my mom, you know, where do you think I obviously learned it from? So that here I am, a five-year-old getting kicked out of kindergarten, literally expelled out of kindergarten for my mouth, for saying the F word, for biting, kicking, punching the teacher, the assistant teacher. They had finally had enough of me, and they kicked me out, and my mom was just disgusted. I remember how angry she was, and I'm home for a few weeks, and I'm playing in the front, and she tells me, Derek, you need to come into the house. It's time to eat. And I say F you to her. And she says, you will never say that to me again. And she pulls me in the house, and I'll never forget looking around. I'm 5 years old at this point. I'm looking around. I see yellow Coors beer cans everywhere. And she drags me up the stairs, and I don't know what's about to happen. And as I'm going up the stairs, she's just yelling at me, so angry, and I hold on to the black iron banister of the stairs, and I just keep holding on, but she rips me apart from that, and she takes me upstairs to the bathroom. She opens the door, slams the door shut, turns on the hot water. And she tells me how bad of a kid I am, that I'm the devil, that I'm just like my dad. And she tells me how bad of a person I am. And I see this steam coming up from the sink and the water there. And I don't know what it is. I don't know what's going on. I have no clue what's about to happen next. She takes my left hand and she holds it under that water faucet for so long. And as I'm screaming, no, Mom, no, Mom, you're hurting me. I love you, Mom. I'm sorry. I see the angriest person I've ever seen to this day. And the reflection of the mirror is my mom, holding me and hurting me. She eventually lets me go. And the skin off the top of my left hand slides right off. It's awful. It's an awful scene. But not only did she burn my heart, burn my left hand, she not only burned that, but she burned into my heart, into my spirit, into my mind, that I was a bad kid, a useless kid. It wasn't much longer after that where she had had enough of me with my stepdad, and they came, and then they went and dropped me off the emergency psychiatric unit, part of the hospital there, and said that we don't want this kid. And from there, I was referred to the county shelter, and that begins my journey into the foster care system for the next 13 years.
Did you ever see her again, Derek?
I saw her once when I was in foster care when I was 6 years old. And then the next time I would see her was when I was 30.
Well, that would be interesting.
The last time I heard her voice was when I was six. The next time I heard her voice was when I was 30. No telephone calls, barely any letters over the years, no visits. What's interesting is I had a brother and sister, and they threw me away. That's the real truth. They kept my brother and sister. So I grew up always knowing that I had a family, was rejected, was abandoned, and always felt like guilt and shame because I was the one that broke up my family because of my behavioral and emotional issues.
But I think it's one of the most important lessons for people who are listening to this show to learn is that the abused victim, especially a child, always feels to blame. You're not alone with that. And feeling guilty has no relationship to reality whatsoever. Guilt is not related to reality. It's actually much more caused by the abuse of the innocent. And even adults who get abused, who get raped, or get horribly abused in some way, women who get battered often blame themselves, often feel guilty. A guilt is not an emotion that has any ethical content to it. And I'm glad you're bringing that up. It's an incredible story. And let me just sit back again and while you talk to us.
It's going to get crazier now. So now I'm in the system, and I have this severe behavioral and emotional issues. And the county decides that they need to get a psychiatric evaluation, actually two, psychological, neurological, and a speech and language evaluation. And what I'm going to tell you, I had to fight in court and won on an appeal. And when you're 18, 19 years old, you can go to the county and request a copy of your records, and they will give them to you. But for my case, in my case, they would not give those to me. It actually was flagged that they could not give them. In fact, my foster sister, who went down to Oakland, the county office there, she was able to get a copy pretty quick, where with me it took months to finally, I went on an appeal. So I'm going to share with you some personal information here of this little six-year-old cute foster kid, Derek Clark. In fact, there's pictures of me on the About Derek section of my website, iwillnevergiveup.com. And I swear, when I saw that first picture of me 6 years old in the foster care system, when I saw that picture years later, I weeped for what I'm about to tell you. I mean, it was just unbelievable.
Yeah, I'm looking at that picture right in your book. In your book, I Will Never Give Up. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So here's what it states about Derek Clark, six-year-old. Derek has a fascination with violence. Derek has a fascination with death, with sex. Derek cannot count to 10. Derek does not know his ABCs, nor can read. Derek doesn't know his math. Derek has erratic psychosis. Derek has severe incapredic and enuretic behavior, which means, I had a major issue with my feces and urine. Every time I got abused or mad at somebody, I would literally urinate on their purse or on their bed or poop on their bed or smear it under their bed or smear it on their clothes. That's the only way I could get back at the abusers. So I had a severe problem, incompetitive and enuretic behavior. I was withdrawn from reality, fascination with knives. I'm 6 years old. I'm mentally retarded. And they gave me, I had to be specially handicapped, psychiatric counseling until I was 12 years old, twice a week. Not adoptable because of my severe behavioral issues and emotional issues. And if an adequate foster home could not be found for me, it states right there that Derek was going to be sent to the institution. And the institution is not very far away from Oakland. It's called Napa. NAPA institution. You know, it's a big institution. Well, it was. And so that's how I came into the system, totally labeled, prepackaged, destined for failure, destined to become nothing and get lost in the system. And, you know, they obviously wanted to put me on all these meds and went through a series of foster homes, back to the shelter, and then the last foster home that was willing to take special high-level at-risk kids, they decided to try me out for a weekend. And I remember going there, my social worker was saying, Derek, you got to be good. You got to be good. This is it. And I was like, okay, okay. So I get there, and my foster dad at that point says, hey, Derek, how you doing? And I'm like, with defiance and rebelliousness, I go, how do you know my name? And I'm screaming at him, how do you know my name? And he goes, whoa, Derek, you got an attitude. Run around. Look at the animals. Well, what was cool about this place was it was a five-acre farm in the San Francisco Bay Area at the top of the hill. And it had goats, chickens, rabbits, pigs, and horses. And all weekend, I communicated basically to animals. I didn't really communicate to any humans. I communicated to animals, and you would find me in the chicken coop, hanging out with my pet red chicken that I named Wilbur. And Wilbur was my friend, and I just loved that chicken, and I just loved, you know, being in that chicken coop and bonding with those animals. Those animals, you know, would not talk back to me, which was cool, and would not show me any disrespect, and would not beat me. And so at the end of that weekend, it was time for me to go, and my social worker comes to pick me up, and I'm throwing the biggest temper tantrum on that driveway, and I'm pounding my head backwards on, and that's what was one of the other things in my psychiatric report, is I had a major problem with pounding my head on concrete. And I would pound my head on concrete back and back, back and forth. And my foster mom says to me, Derek, we don't act like that. Stand up. What do you want? And I go, where am I going to go? I have no place to go. I have no place to go. And she goes to my social worker, can we try him out for another week? And the social worker said, sure. And then that week turned into a month. And then that month turned into a year. And then that turned into years. They're my mom and dad. They never gave up on me. My foster mom and dad have earned the title of mom and dad. So that's how I came into the system right there. It was pretty traumatic, and I had a lot of behavioral issues. What they found out when I was about 9, when I was starting to read, was that I was a sponge, that I was not mentally handicapped, that I had just major behavioral anger and rage issues. That was my main thing. I was an angry and raging kid who did not trust, who did not love, and that was my life right there for years, until I was 18 years old, for years. But they never gave up on me, and they chose to not put me on medication. And here's what they did. It's kind of like when I go out and speak and share this story with people, it's kind of extreme, but this is what they did. My mom and dad, my mom was a juvenile hall teacher who stopped being that and decided to be a homemaker, and my dad was a second grade teacher. And here's what they did for me. They decided not to get me on medication. We lived on a farm. They took away all sugar cereal, all soda, candy. I only ate vegetables and meat from the farm generally. No video games. Whenever all of my friends had video games, I did not have a video game. TV 1 hour a week. No fast food at all. And it was pretty extreme. They worked me. I lived on a farm, so I had responsibility, accountability, and I was worked. And that's where I got my my hard work ethics and all that stuff. So, but what's interesting is, you know, when I grew up, one of the first things I did when I left the house was get my own, you know, get a cabinet full of sugar cereals and soda and got my video game. So I got on that after a while, but then, you know, all that stuff died down. But it was like, because I couldn't have it for years, you know, fast food or anything like that. But I am sure that is.
Derek, did you stay in touch with your foster family?
Yes, they are my mom and dad. In fact, they called yesterday. Yeah, I mean, we touch base every few weeks and see them often. And yeah, they're my mom and dad. When Christmas comes around, that's where I go.
At what point can you were you beginning to really turn the corner? Can you kind of identify the time?
Yeah, I was about 14, 15 years old. I had been suspended over and over again out of elementary school throughout high school for fighting and rage and anger and violence. And I was starting to do better around 14, 15 years old. And then I got suspended once again for fighting, and then I went out of control. I was just tired of everybody, tired of church pastors, Boy Scouts, everybody, all adults. I had no problem swinging on an adult, getting in a fight with an adult, whether it was the pastor at a church camp out or the leader at a Boy Scout camp. If they told me what to do, they were going to have it. And so I was tired and angry, and I wanted to get out of that foster home. And I thought the way to get out was, if I remember love growing up from my biological family, it would have been from my sister. She was 10 years older than I. And so I thought, you know what? I want to get a hold of my sister. And I had just gotten suspended out of high school. And my foster mom, I guess, called the county social worker. A social worker came. I was hanging out in his car, and he was talking to me, saying, Derek, you're always in trouble. What's going on? And I remember saying, you don't know me. You don't know me at all, because it was a new social worker. It seemed like I had a new social worker every couple months. So it was, how awful was that to, you know, try to start to build trust and then they get taken away. So that's why I never had, you know, I never wanted to build trust with anybody, because you're going to leave me. So he said to me, Derek, you're always in trouble. And I said, you don't know me. And he goes, well, I want to know you. And I said, well, if you want something from me, I want something from you. I need my sister's address, because I want to write her a letter. Well, a few weeks later, I get my sister's address, and I write my sister a letter. And I had not heard from her in 10 years, not even a letter from her, nothing. And I write a letter to my sister saying, hey, this is your little baby brother, Derek. I don't know if you remember me, but I totally remember you. Please, you know, write back. I want to talk to you. I want to get to know you. And I sent it out, and about a month and a half later, I get a letter back from her saying, oh, my gosh, my little baby brother, I totally remember you. I care about you. Send me your phone number. I want to come see you. And so I'm thinking, oh, okay, great. I'm going to be able to go live with my sister, because I always knew I had a family. And I waited by that mailbox for a long time, and I never got a call. I never got a letter. In fact, I never got a letter ever again. That's the last time I ever heard from my sister ever. I get a letter about a year later from my biological mom stating that my sister was shot and killed on Mother's Day. Shot in the head in her bed, two kids in the house, my niece and nephew. And I was devastated. And I grieved that, and I tried to get over it. And the biggest mentor in my life at that point was my foster brother, who was about 8 years older than I. And every time I run away to an abandoned house, abandoned barn, or I'd find a way down to my brother's house. And this one time I ran away, I was hanging down there, and he was like, why do you treat my mom and dad like that? And I'm all, well, I'm angry. Don't get me mad. And I was like 17 years old. And he's like, Derek, you've got to learn to control yourself. And I'm like, don't get me mad. And I could turn on anybody. Well, he always tried to work with me, and he was the biggest mentor of my life. I mean, I learned motocross, learned fishing and camping and hiking, all these great things that a big brother did with you. I go back home, and I'm hanging out there a few months, and I come home one day and from an event or something, and I see my foster mom and dad crying. And I had never seen that before, like literally bawling. And I'm wondering what's going on, and I say to him, what's going on? Because I thought maybe I had to leave. Maybe they were tired of me. And they look up to me and they say, because they were at the bottom of the stairs, they look up and they say, Derek, your brother was just killed. My brother? The biggest mentor in my life? I got to tell you, I was devastated. I was angry. And that's where I turned my whole life into pure bitterness and raging and hatred at about 17 years old. My other friend, not too long after that, was killed. So I had three deaths. Within a year and a half, my sister, my brother, and my friend. And I...
Can you quickly say, how did these deaths come about, and then we're going to go to break?
Okay. My sister was shot and killed by her soon-to-be ex-brother-in-law, who was angry that she was divorcing his brother. My foster brother, who was the biggest influence in my life, was killed in an airplane crash that he was a pilot in. and my good friend was killed. His dad shot him, shot his sister, and then the dad killed himself in a murder-suicide over a bad divorce. And that's how it all happened right there. So that all happened at a pivotal point in my life, 16 and 17 years old.
Well, I sure would like to be able to figure out for the first time in my life, perhaps, how it is that some people go through the kind of abuse and horror and loss that would turn any of us into a maniac and don't, and somehow go in the other direction. Let's try to focus on that. Maybe you can rap about it when we come back. And Giselle, let's go to break now. Bring on the music.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. My fabulous guest is Derek W. Clark. You can find him at IWillNeverGiveUp.com. That's his book, too. Derek, tell us, lead us into the light about how someone like yourself turns it around.
Okay. Let me back up one little, because it's a quick little tidbit that you got to be able to see how I grew from this, too. Now, I had a fascination with knives, and my foster parents throughout the years would always try to hide the knives from me. And, in fact, whenever I was mad at them, I would come at them with my finger like a knife and go at their stomach or at their chest or something. So my foster parents would tell you they were always, like, scared of me, like, what is he going to do? Well, this one time I found a razor blade. And this razor blade I would keep in my shoe, and I would use it as a weapon sometimes, as a threatening weapon. I never used it, per se, at that point in my life. But my neighbor would not go down our hill on his bike. And so I took that razor blade out at about 11 years old. And I said, if you don't go down this hill on this bike, I'm going to slice you. And he's like, no, Derek, I'm scared. And he's probably about 8 or 9 years old. And he would not go down, so I took the razor blade and I started slicing at him. And it covered his, you know, like he put his hands up and tried covering his face. And I sliced his hand, but not only did I slice his hand, I sliced that web between the thumb and the first finger all the way down to the bone, that skin web, all the way down, that crevice right there. And I remember seeing blood there and going, oh, my gosh, I really hurt somebody that time. And eventually he had to go get stitched. It was pretty crazy situation. So that just explains the whole violence of me, too, hurting people. So now I'm, let's jump back to, I'm now 18
years old. You're how old?
I'm about 11.
Wow.
And so now I'm 18 years old. My brother has been killed. My sister, my friend has been killed, right? And I'm out of control. And unfortunately, it's sad to say, but I caused a lot of violence at school, and I got expelled my senior year in high school, got kicked out. I'm now 18 years old, and I do not know what to do with my life. I'm figuring I'm out of the foster home because it's what they call aged out. You're aging out. The checks stop coming to the foster home, and that's it. And so my foster parents are like, you know, what are we going to do with you? My foster dad calls the county. They don't know what to do with me. And my dad finds a program. He spends several hundred dollars out of his own pocket to put me in this 3-day course of understanding yourself and understanding your anger and rage. This is a crazy program. You want me to tell you about it?
I want you to tell me anything that's going to help my listeners and me, and maybe you, get how it is that you pull yourself out of this.
Okay, this is how I pulled myself out of it right here, 18 years old. He wants me to go to this three-day program from early in the morning till midnight, basically, a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And I go, and I do not like it because I'm walking in, and there's 15 other youth that are having their issues, and there is a husband and wife counselor on this makeshift stage and three stools. And everybody gets a chance to sit on the middle stool. And I'm listening to people tell about their lives, like whether they were raped or molested or drug abuse and what their parents did and all this stuff. And I'm thinking, how I will not get up there and talk about my life. I was used to psychiatric counseling behind closed doors, and now I've got to talk in front of everybody and share my life? No way. Well, you know, people would be on that stage for a few hours, and there would be a lot of emotions, a lot of anger, a lot of tears. And so eventually it was my turn, and it said, Derek, it's time for you to come up here. And I'm like, no, I'm not coming up there. I'm not coming up there. I'm not going to share any of this stuff with you. And I start cussing. No, Derek, everybody comes up here. And then everybody starts cheering, Derek, 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 Derek. And, you know, I was trying to be invisible, but finally I get up there. And the counselor, the wife there, the woman, says, we understand that your mom didn't want you. And I'm like, what? Don't talk about my mom. What are you talking about? How do you know this stuff? Well, it turned out that my dad had filled out questionnaires about, you know, everything about me so he could have these counselors try to help me. And I'm getting frustrated and angry and cussing and out of control. And she goes, that's exactly what we want to see you doing, Derek, right now. We want to see you angry, in your rage. And I'm like, what? No, Derek, we want to see you mad. And I go, I will flip out. And I point to my dad, because my mom and dad were there, my foster mom and dad were there, and I said, hi, Dad, I will flip out. And my dad goes, yeah, he will flip out. She goes, okay, that's fine. What we'll do is we'll bring three grown men up. And they had a bunch of, like, support staff there. And they brought three men up, and if you get out of control, Derek, these three men will restrain you. And I'm like, no, I don't like anybody touching me. I don't want anybody touching me. And they say to me, okay, she says to me, Derek, what we'll do then is we'll put the three men right in front of you, one behind the other, one holding up the other, and if you get mad, you just push with both hands on the first guy, and the other two guys will hold them up. And I'm like, oh, okay, so you want me to just push, and I'm like kind of cussing and stuff. Just push.
Now, are you big then? You're 6'5" now. What do you like then?
I'm 6'5" at that point, 18 years old. I'm a big guy.
Okay, go ahead.
And so... yeah, and a lot more, you know, I had been lifting weights and stuff than I am now. So, I mean, you know, a lot big, hefty weight, you know, yoke, they call it. So, that's a muscle. And so she starts going into when I was burned by a little, you know, as a little kid. She starts going into how my mom didn't want me. All these things to invoke anger. And I flip out. I push all three of those grown men to the ground, and I go after that lady because I'm going to hurt her. It's not, it's known. I was going to hurt her. And as I start walking to her, cussing her out, yelling, breathing, you know, frothing from the mouth, just spitting, just anger, she kept saying, Derek, no, no. Derek, you know how great you are? Derek, you know how great you are? How much power you got? Derek, we love you. And as I get closer to her, she says, Derek, do you know how great you are? She's screaming at me. And I slow down and I look at her. And for the first time, I cried in a long time out of my eyes. And I was not a crying type of guy. I did not cry because crying was a sign of weakness, especially in foster care. You don't cry. And she said to me, you know how great you are. You're great, Derek. Use your power for the good. You're great. And she's hesitant, but she comes closer to me, and she puts her hand on my shoulder. And then she comes in and gives me a hug, and I bawl like a baby on her shoulder. The reason why I bawled is I can identify it, because generally when I was angry and when I was mad, out of control, people would say to me, there's Derek again acting out of control. There's Derek again acting crazy. And all it would do literally is fuel my fire. You're right. I'm going to act crazy. But here's somebody who I did not know that saw something in me that I couldn't even see in me. How great I was, how much I had overcome, how much value I could give to this world. And I cried for just bawling, sobbing. And then she did a hand signal, and the rest of the group came up and started to give me a group hug. and I started to push back from everybody, and my walls were coming back up because I was embarrassed that they were there. I forgot they were there. And I'm drying my tears. I'm going, no, man, I'm cool, I'm cool, I'm cool. And she goes, Derek, you need to feel it. You need to feel it to heal. You need to feel to heal. Feel it, Derek. Feel it. And then the group just totally bum-rushed me. And they grabbed me, and they just held me. And I will never, ever forget that warmth, that power of that group hug, ever, in my life. And I came out of that 3 days, like Oprah would say, your big aha moment, with a new clarity, with a new perspective. You know, Dr. Wayne Dyer says, you know, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. Well, I changed the way I looked at my past, that I realized it wasn't my fault, that I was no longer going to be defined by my parents' mistakes. I wasn't going to be defined by my own mistakes that I've made, that I was never going to let my past infect my future, and that I was going to take responsibility for the direction of my life. I was going to own myself. I was going to define myself. And that is the pivotal point in my life at 18 years old, where I took responsibility for the direction of my life, and my life went straight up after that. That's where it happened.
Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Clark. Wow.
I learned right there, Doctor, that I was never going to let a weakness or my parents' weakness destroy my greatness. And I learned right there that you cannot start the next chapter in your life if you keep rereading the last one. So I wasn't going to let my past infect me anymore. That it wasn't about my IQ, it was about my I will. And I had the will. I had the will.
Would you like to tell us now more about the growth that then took place? This is such an incredible story. We could just say, that's it, folks. We'll end the show 20 minutes early. It's so good what you're saying. Talk some now about the growth that took place after you were 18. Did you work with that group or those people any further? Did you get any other counseling help?
Nope, that's it. Now, let me tell you, I became a winner in life. I mean, I found my potential. I found that you cannot think negative and discouraging thoughts and expect to live a positive and rewarding life. I also found that what's happened to me, like all the abuse and the rejection, was not as important as what's happened inside of me, that I was no longer going to let the inner me become the enemy. I was done. I was done with the pity. It was all about the power. And so I moved forward. That's what I did. I got into real estate when I was 23. I got married. I found the woman of my dreams, and got into.
You're still together?
Yeah, I've been married 18 years.
Congratulations.
I have 4 kids from one woman.
Wonderful.
And let me tell you about this. After at 18 years old, the county got a hold of the superintendent. I was reinstated back in high school in March. And it was known that I was not going to graduate high school, and that's just the way it was. But part of the prerequisite for me coming back to high school is I had to spend the 5th and 6th period in the vice principal's office, for the teachers didn't want me in their class, which is understandable. And I remember my guidance counselor saying to me, Derek, you know you're not going to graduate, so what are you going to do with your life? What are you going to do with your life? And I thought, man, what am I going to do with my life? And I worked my butt off for the next 2 months in that vice principal's office. And do you know that I graduated high school with a 1.83 GPA? 1.83. Now, that number is really special to me. Now, that number can't get you in any university. That number actually limits you. But let me tell you how it's unlimiting to me. Because I am the first one in my family to graduate high school. My mom dropped out in the 8th grade. My dad dropped out in high school. So that 1.83 is the start of a new person breaking the cycle, and then my kids, when they grow up, they're going to get so much better, and that's how we change the generation right there. You know, so I got into real estate when I was 23. I made my first 100 grand, I think, by the time I was 25, my first million by the time I was 31, and I wrote a song called Goodnight Soldier. My life went straight up for years. And I wrote a song called Goodnight Soldier in 2006. One of my client's sons was killed in Iraq. And 2 weeks, the night after the funeral, I wrote this song, and I put it out as an MP3 and emailed it to all my friends. 2 weeks later, I get a radio station. Then another radio station called me, can they play the song? Then all of a sudden, I've got 10,000 hits on my website, then 30,000, then close to a million. And then I get a call from my congressman saying, hey, would you like to sing that song for President Bush? So I went all the way within 6 months to President Bush.
Wow.
And as I met him, I may not agree with all the policies, but there's 330 million people in the United States. How many people get to meet a president of the United States and perform for him? How many people? I have a great picture. He sent me a great picture with him, my wife, me, and my son, and he autographed it. And he gave my son the lapel pin, the presidential lapel pin, all this stuff. I mean, it was unbelievable. And I received thousands of emails. Now, at this point, no one knew I was a foster kid because I kept it hidden for years and years by the time I was 19. I no longer talked about it anymore. But I got an email out of the thousands of emails that said, tell me more about your life, your song, I Want to Be a Kid. There's a song out there, I Want to Be a Kid, W-A-N-N-A, I Want to Be a Kid. Just Google it. You'll see it everywhere. And there's a great video to it. And that is a letter to my biological mom when I met her at 30 years old. And I turned the letter into a song, and it's a very, very powerful song. Well, as soon as I read that email from that lady saying, tell me more about your life, I just got baptized to that song. I was like, oh my gosh, someone got baptized to my song. It's unbelievable. Something told me deep within that I need to write a book. So I followed it. I wrote that first book, I Will Never Give Up. And it started taking off, and that is what created the purpose of my life. Because for my life, most of my life as an adult, I was all about business. And then I realized in 2006, 2007 that I had a purpose, a calling, and that was to give hope, to share my message of hope with, an inspiration with the world. And that's what happened. You know, this little six-year-old, five-year-old foster kid that was given up on grew up to write five books, to have over 125 tracks just on the iTunes, to speak to thousands upon thousands of people. I was recently on CNN Headline News with Jane Velez Mitchell. I'm a child welfare foster care expert on CNN. And we discussed the whole Josh Cowell case recently where he, from social worker, dropped off the kids. So didn't drop off the kids. The kids ran ahead. He opened the door, slammed the door, and the house blew up a few minutes later and killed the kids and him. So I was, brought on there, and I'm sharing my message in front of millions of viewers. It's just an unbelievable journey in my life. It's an unbelievable journey, and I know it's not over, and it's a story of resilience. It's a story of redemption. That's my life.
It's a wonderful, wonderful story. When you say that you realize your life has purpose, does that have a connection to God for you, or is it a more secular kind of realization?
Oh no, I have a very great spirituality. Yeah, it's about God. In fact, my foster dad's favorite book is a book I wrote called I Will Never Give Up on God Again. From feeling abandoned by God to feeling embraced by God. It's an unbelievable book. Yeah.
Well, this is a show where you can talk about that. So I'd love to hear more about that, your development of a belief in God. What role it's played in your life?
Yeah, that's actually a long story, because how many minutes do we have left?
about three and a half, I would say.
Yeah. Well, all I can say is this, really, because it really gets into it. We had a little girl drowned in our pool, and she was gone dead for over 10 minutes. And it was just an unbelievable situation on the 4th of July a few years ago. And my life changed from that point. With the power of prayer, that girl lived. It was unbelievable. And I knew at that point that God had not abandoned me. I'd always felt for years that he abandoned me, so I abandoned him. And one day I realized that, he's always had a purpose for me. He's always had me, always been watching me. How come I never did drugs? I was 13 years old and had a joint in my mouth. And something told me that if I smoke this joint, I'm going to end up like my mom and dad. And guess what? I took that joint out of my mouth, and I never inhaled. I've never done a drug. I've never had a problem with drugs. So, you know, I realize that he's always been there leading me, directing my footsteps to get me to the point where I am today. Now, the big thing, the big twist to all this is they eventually found my dad, my biological dad, and who I had not seen, you know, obviously for years. They found him at Folsom State Prison for the criminally insane for a string of armed robberies from Arizona to California. And so he died in 2005, I believe. I never had an opportunity to meet him. Never did I have a feeling that I ever wanted to. But I did hire an investigator to find out where he was, and he had just died. So, you know, now he's looking down at me saying, look what I created. Because I thank him, and I thank my mom for the adversity that I've gone through. I thank them. I know that sounds crazy, but I would not be as strong as who I am, and I would not be strong and have the character that I have today without what they gave me in life. They were great teachers. And I love that quote by Jeffrey Gennemer that says, we all have a bag of cement and water to carry in life. Are we going to make a stumbling block or a stepping stone? That's the truth right there.
Marvelously put, Derek Clark. Marvelously, marvelously put. You know, one of the things I want to take a second to get in is, you know, folks, when you meet a child from now on, a little boy or girl, and that boy or girl is enraged and hateful and wants to do horrible things and is violent, remember, that's the child's pride. That's the child saying, you'll have to kill me before I give up my pride, my last remnants of a self. And that's what so much of it is about, that we're trying to drug out of our kids and diagnose out of our kids, is their actual fighting words, their determination not to be caved in and destroyed. And thank God that the drugs never got to you. And thank God you never started using street drugs, because it is hard to get past inundating your brain with psychoactive substances. And I'm just 100% with everything you're saying, Derek. It's one of the best hours I've had with anyone in or out of the radio.
Thank you.
And
thank
I,
you so
I just deeply appreciate your honesty and your communication. And I just admire very, very much what you're saying. I'm going to recommend that all the people I'm working with listen to this particular show. It's got one lesson piled on another. Do you have a closing word?
Well, you know, I'm thankful for life. I love that quote that says, I've never met a bitter person who is thankful, or a thankful person who is bitter. I'm healed, Peter.
Yes.
I forgave my mom. And that is the ultimate power right there.
That's be the grateful for this life. Be grateful for this life.
I'm grateful to be a dad every single day and to break the cycle. I'm grateful to have the vision and the strength and the faith to say that I was not going to repeat the mistakes of my parents. And I'm a crazy fun type of guy. So, you know, you don't let defeat and adversity make you bitter. You let it make you better. There you go. Derek Clark in the house. Look me up on Facebook. Check out my website, iwillnevergiveup.com. And my Facebook name is Derek, D-E-R-E-K. Middle name is Never Give Up. Last name, Clark. And send me a message. And thank you so much for, you know, having me out on here.
So thank you very, very, very much, Derek Clark.
Okay.
Take care, Peter. This is Dr. Peter Breggin saying goodbye and being grateful for Derek Clark.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Breggin and his lifelong reform work on www.breggin.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.